Welcome along, Explorer. It is time to search the solar system. We are seeking out some science secrets in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you so much for being there. This is the place where we trawl all around the galaxy, a little bit further too, in about half an hour, and we find some science that, well, we've never really heard before. Today, we will carry on our quest to find the greatest science of them all with a big argument about something tiny.
I find new species to science and microbes that haven't been found for more than 100 years. So they are extremely rare, but I do manage to find them. And that is great information for the scientific world.
And we'll answer your questions. We do it every single week with a proper genius. This week, it's all about smart speakers.
These machine learning technologies are really quite clever. In fact, our speakers continuously improve how good they are at recognizing our individual voices. So these machine learning models are continuously being trained by our use of them.
And you can hear about something tiny trying to burrow inside of you. It's all on the way in a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. Let's kick things off with your science in the news. Normally, a place should see a total solar eclipse once every 375 years. There's one part of America, though. They're about to get their second one in just 7 years. Total solar eclipse is when the moon blocks out the sun completely. It's quite rare because the path of the Earth in its orbit around the sun, the part of the moon in its orbit around the Earth, and the spin of the Earth have to be completely right. It normally never happens. It's so precise. But it's happening for the second time in 7 years in part of America. Scientists expect the sky to go pitch black for just over 4 minutes. Also, a fossil that is 270 million years old has been named Kermit Gratus after Kermit the Frog. It helps experts understand where amphibians like frogs came from. It looks a lot like Kermit, so they've named it after him, which makes sense. But if you know anything about Kermit in movies, he's very shy, isn't he? I wonder how embarrassed he will be having a fossil named in his honour. In our final story this week, glass found in a prehistoric settlement was probably made in Iran. That's what scientists say. The glass was found in beads over in Must Farm, a place that's been nicknamed Britain's Pompeii. It's over 3,000 years old. It's almost 3,000 miles away from Iran. Let's find out more. Chris Wakefield is an archaeologist who works with Must Farm. Chris, thank you for being there. We call this Britain's Pompeii. That's a big comparison. What makes it that?
So the comparison with Pompeii is really, if you imagine that kind of snapshot that's being captured in time, it's this moment that has been frozen for us to find as archaeologists. So in the same way that Pompeii was buried in that volcanic eruption, this is a series of houses that would have been built on stilts over a river, and a massive fire has burnt everything down, and that destruction from that blaze has basically kept everything preserved for us to find as archaeologists. So we're finding bowls of food with the meal still inside them and spoons sticking out the top of them. We're finding the preserved poo of the people who are living there. We're getting a huge amount of really exciting stuff that we're digging out of the ground.
How long have we known about Must Farm, and how long have we been digging to see what's there?
So the site was first discovered just over 20 years ago, but we didn't really start to do a big dig there until 2015. And that dig took about a year of our time. And in that, like over the course of that dig, we found thousands and thousands of different prehistoric objects. And it's the most incredible thing to be working as an archaeologist.
So the question then is, I guess, why are we taking so long with it, right? If you find this hoard of stuff, you're an archaeologist, it's what you love. Why are there not people there every second of every day doing it? Why are we kind of dragging it out like this?
So within that sort of year that we took to dig the site, we dug up everything that was in there. So we had a team of archaeologists that were working every minute of every day digging that up. But the reason we're talking about it now is that it takes a lot of time to do all of the scientific research to understand exactly what the things that we're finding are, how old they are, and for the case of those bowls of food, actually doing lots and lots of scientific techniques to find out what exactly the meals were, the recipes that the people were eating in the Bronze Age.
So we hear about this glass that's been found in beads in Must Farm. And We know it's from Iran. What's helped us pair and link those?
So if you imagine when glass is made, it's made of lots and lots of different materials that kind of make up that object. So we can do really, really cool scientific techniques that work out exactly the different proportions of all of the different elements inside that. And by looking at kind of different examples of beads that have been found and studied in different parts of the world, we're able to work out that the ones that were found at Masfarm would probably have been made around 4,500 kilometers away.
Wow, over in Iran. So international travel back then was not like it is now. You can just hop on a plane and fly to the Middle East. How have they found themselves here, do we think?
So if you imagine, again, this is sort of technologies that we don't have the ways to travel that we do today. So those beads were probably traded lots and lots of times to make their way from that place in the Middle East all the way over to the fens in eastern England. But what's really interesting is you would have thought that that process might have taken a really long time for those beads to travel. But actually, the beads aren't that different in date to the houses that we're finding. So it must have actually happened quite quickly for those beads to make their way over there.
So Masfarm is a site that's over 3,000 years old. What have we learned about how people lived back then? What would the settlement have looked like? How far away would it have been from other big settlements nearby? What did they do every day?
So the site's almost 3,000 years old. It's not over 3,000 years. It's nearly quite. So it's about from 850 BC. And those houses were quite interesting because they would have been built on stilts. So again, quite different from a lot of the houses that we know from that period. And they would have been directly over a river, and around the outside of that was a really big fence of sharpened stakes that were kind of pointed and sticking up there, probably to help be defended. So if they were attacked, they could kind of retreat inside the houses in the settlement. And inside them, what's really exciting, we know loads about exactly how they would have been living inside the houses. So we know that they would have had sheep and goats living inside their houses with them. So if you were having, sitting around in your living room in 850 BC, there'd have been a sheep and a goat probably pooing and going to the toilet in there, because we've even found the little sheep and goat poos in the floor of those buildings. We know that they would have been kind of cooking and had kitchen areas. They would have been making textiles and clothing, and they would have even had toolkits made of different metal objects as well.
Chris Wakefield, it's been such a joy to have you on. Thank you so much for telling us all about Masfarm.
Great to chat to you.
Thank you so much to Chris Wakefield for coming on, for helping us dig underground and hear about Britain's Pompeii. We'll have another expert on the show in just a second answering one of your questions. It's my favourite part, my favourite time, when you send over your questions, normally as voice notes, to the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com, and then I find a genius to sort it out for you. First one this week, it's a message that's from Ben, who wants to know, what's the best planet to move to? Well, Ben, I've done some digging on this. It's very hard to tell, right? Because humans haven't visited properly any other planets. And a lot of scientists think different things. It's all about what the atmosphere is like, how hot it is, how strong the gravity is, whether we could grow stuff there. Quite a lot of experts think that Mercury would be good. It is the closest planet to the Sun, though. Strangely, it's a bit cooler than Mars. They think there might be water on Mercury, too. Also, they think the North and South Pole of Mercury would be pretty good, because the day and night times are quite similar to ours here on Earth, and the strength of the gravity there isn't horrendous, so humans wouldn't be squashed as soon as we touch down. But the atmosphere doesn't really have oxygen. And that's what we need to breathe. That's what makes our Earth so perfect. So if we did go to Mercury or any other planet, really, we would need to find a way to have oxygen, probably build huge greenhouses, really. Massive see-through tents that we all could live in, Ben. Thank you so much for the question. Let's get on another one. This is a voice note on the Free Fun Kids app by Aiden. What do you got?
How do Alexas work?
Well, Aiden, thank you so much for your question. How do Alexas work? Are the smart speakers knocking around as well? Let's find out with Pip Knight from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the smartest schools in the world. Pip, thank you for being there. So Alexas and other smart speakers, they are all over the place. They're incredibly smart. Where do we begin by talking about how they work?
Yeah, that's a great question, Aiden. Thank you very much. So smart speakers are really interesting, and we can start thinking about how they work by dividing it into a few stages. So we've got to have some kind of microphone in our speaker that detects what we're saying to the speaker, and then we've got to take that output from the microphone, which is an electrical signal, and interpret what sentence has been said in English, and then finally from that sentence decide what task we're actually asking our smart speaker to do. So we can delve into each of those stages in a little bit more detail. So starting with the microphone, I find it easiest to think about the microphones in smart speakers as like miniaturized drums, but working in a slightly backwards way from drums that we've interpreted in our lives. So when we hit a drum, it has a drum skin which vibrates in a special pattern, and the vibrations of the drum skin cause vibrations in the air molecules, which will then travel to our ears and we'll hear that sound. In the case of these microphones, which are called capacitive microphones, we're saying a sentence which travels as sound waves in the air and then causes the drum skin to vibrate. But in the microphone case, we call that drum skin a diaphragm. And these are miniaturized diaphragms, and they're separated from a stationary plate by a fixed air gap. And the stationary plate is connected to the diaphragm by an external circuit. We charge up the diaphragm with one charge and the stationary plate with the opposite charge so that they're attracting each other. And then as that diaphragm vibrates up and down, the force that's attracting those two will change, which we measure over time as a voltage. So we've now got this electrical signal, and we need to interpret it as a sentence in English. So the way this used to be done is by understanding that words in English are divided into little chunks called phonemes, which make up each word. And we use a computer via a machine learning process to interpret each little chunk of the sound in the electrical signal as an individual phoneme. So it'll take that chunk of sound and output what phoneme it is. And then we add those together to make words and sentences. In fact, these days, it's actually usually done all in one step, not needing the phonemes, in a process called end-to-end deep learning, if you're ever interested to Google that.
We imagine when we speak to our smart speaker that there's almost like a little person or something in there that's, you know, typing away at the laptop, really, and searching whatever we want. Like that's how it's able to interpret whatever we're saying. But you're saying that in the early days, it was understanding each part of our word separately and just making electrical signals from it.
Well, exactly. In the early days, it really was quite mechanical. So the very first voice recognition technology was only trained to interpret numbers. So it was called Audrey, and it was just trained to be able to recognize the digits 1 to 9. So that was really interesting. But these days, these machine learning technologies are really quite clever. In fact, our speakers continuously improve how good they are at recognizing our individual voices. So these machine learning models are continuously being trained by our use of them. So they'll get really good at understanding your voice, but maybe not your friend's voice if your friend isn't around so often. It's really quite clever.
Oh, that's amazing, isn't it? It's like we've designed these things and they are learning as they go, this machine learning. How complicated is the inside, Pip? If you were to break open a smart speaker, very simply, what would you see in front of you?
These microphones that I was talking about are really very small. So I was talking about it like a drum, but they're actually kind of micron scale. So a micron is a thousandth of a millimeter. So they're really very small. And in fact, designs that people are thinking about for the future, which include kind of more exotic types of crystals called piezoelectric crystals. Some designs are including materials that are literally one atomic layer thick, so called graphene, which is a two-dimensional material with these piezoelectric nanowires. So actually, in the case of a nanowire, 1 nanometer is a millionth of a millimeter. So they're really, really, really tiny. You'd only be able to look at those structures with a very special microscope. So yeah, these designs are getting more and more sensitive as we engineer these nanoscale materials even more carefully.
Right. Well, thank you. I think we've covered that. Aidan, that is how Alexas work. Pip Knight from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, thank you so much for joining us.
No worries.
Let's check out this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we take a look at some of the most mean, weird, strange and unique things from across the universe. This time, it's about a creature from the outside that wants to get to your inside. Now, this is pretty gruesome. We're going to the wilds of Central and South America to take a look at the sand flea. Its proper science name is Tunga penetrans. It's a parasitical flea. And parasites, they live off other creatures, right? They let you do the hard work, they sap your energy and your blood. Normally, it lives just underground, in the sand, at a perfect spot. It's about 3 centimetres below because it's not too hot there, but it's not low enough that there isn't a lot of oxygen. So they normally live there. That's where their babies, their larvae, can grow. But when they come out, if it gets near you, it can bite, it can burrow right inside of you. It loves to get through thinner skin, like around your feet, so near your toenails. Rubbish! If you want to walk on the sand in barefoot, and when it's inside you, it feeds on your blood. It starts to grow eggs. These can get big, they can pus, they can ooze. They can cause a brutal infection in you. And these infections can cause severe damage to your skin and your muscles around your legs and your feet. And then they break free. They try and burrow their larva babies in the sand, and then it starts all over again and all over again. And that is why the sand flea, this strange, gross, parasitical beast, goes straight onto our dangerous Dan list. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Time to check in with our Battle of the Sciences. Every week, we invite a genius, an expert, to come on and tell us why their field should be first. Today, we are headed to the University of Bournemouth, chatting to Dr. Genoveva Esteban, who is on. She's a doctor of microbiology, and she's telling us why studying microbes is the best type of science. Genoveva, you have 1 minute to tell us why it's the best. You can start in 3, 2, 1, go!
Hello everyone. So I think my research is the best because I get to see the invisible world. I get to see organisms that no one else gets to see, and I feel that that is very, very special. I find new species to science and microbes that haven't been found for more than 100 years. So they are extremely rare, but I do manage to find them, and that is great information for the scientific world. The other very important thing about microorganisms is that they are the oldest life forms on Earth, and evolution on Earth wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the microorganisms. So they are really, really crucial for the planet. They are also responsible for the functioning of the natural world, the oceans, lakes, rivers, soils, you name it. They all depend on the microscopic life that lives within them.
Genoveva, that is your minute done. So much. Thank you for doing that. There's so much that I need to ask you about. Microbes, tiny organisms. You said that you discover ones that are 100 years old that we didn't know of before. Where are we finding them? How do you know where to look for these microbes?
Well, I try to find in habitats or ecosystems that are very rare in the sense that no one is going to look at them. So they are usually places that are very smelly, for example, because there is no oxygen in them. So there is a lot of decomposition going on. There's a lot of bacteria there. If you think, for example, in the sediment of some lakes, then I go and sample there with a special bottle, and then I find these organisms after looking down the microscope for many, many, many hours. And then I find them, and then I take photos, and some of them are new species, so I have to do the whole description, morphological descriptions, explaining what they look like. And then I do the DNA as well. And then I get it published. So it's really fascinating world. And all these organisms are just one cell. They have one cell only. So if we think of our body, for example, we have maybe 3 trillion cells. These organisms is just one. And they have to find food. They need to reproduce as well. And these microorganisms that I study are not bacteria. So they are bigger than bacteria. And they actually eat bacteria, so they are very good for the environment because they clean the water out of bacteria.
So if they're one cell, these are tiny, how do you know that one microbe is completely different from another when you're looking at them through the microscope? What's telling you that these things are different and strange and unique?
So what we do, we look at particular features on the cell. So many of these organisms that I investigate have a proper mouth. So we look at, using special coloring techniques, we can look at the structure of the mouth. And then that is one of the features that we use for identifying the different species. That's one of them. The other feature that we also look at, so because these organisms have to swim in the environment, for that they use tiny little hairs that they have. So they have like rows, many rows of cilia of these hairs to swim in the environment. So we need to count how many of those rows of cilia they have and how many the amount of cilia of these little hairs that they have. So we look at, different anatomical features, if you like, and then we say, oh, yeah, this looks as though this hasn't been observed before. We need to go through all the scientific literature as well. So it is very time-consuming. But also, because I've been looking at these microorganisms for a long time now, then I have really very good idea whether it's new or not.
Well, there we go, making a big case for why tiny cells should come first in our battle of the sciences. Dr. Genevieve Esteban from the University of Bournemouth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Genevieve for coming on the show. Loved hearing all about microbes. I think that goes quite high in our battle of the sciences. Just imagine spending your time searching around the world for things that are so, so small. We can learn more about microbes now, what they are, where we might find them, why they are good and bad for you, with our series Benny and Mao. They are our microbe friends. They dive into the exciting world of microbiology. They normally live inside your gut, but they're travelling around helping us find different tiny species. And this week, they're letting us know the different ways that microbes can get into your body.
Good Bugs, Bad Bugs, with support from the Society for General Microbiology.
Microbes get everywhere. They're on us, in us, and around us. If you've got a microscope, like me, you can see them for yourself. Look!
All right there.
That's Benny. He's a helpful sort of microbe. Lots of microbes are.
Not you again. Can't you leave us in peace?
And that's Mal. He's not very nice. A few microbes are horrible, and they're called germs.
Charming. I'm not all that keen on you either.
Hey, easy, Mal, mate. You're not doing yourself any favours there.
So, what's up, guys?
Well, today we thought we'd take a bit of a look around that human body of yours and check out the microbes you're sharing your body with.
You're crawling with microbes, teeming with them.
You're making it sound bad there, Mal. Think of it more like a superhero shield or, I know, a lovely city of different types of bacteria all going about their business, just all over your body, especially the warm and wet bits.
Including in your belly button. Oh, I love it when you get a good bit of fluff in there. On a normal grown-up skin, you could find a trillion bacteria of over 1,000 different types and a handful of fungi too, including yeasts.
And that grown-up wouldn't be all like, ah, get these microbes off me, would he, Mal? He...
Or she.
Or she. Good point, Mal. He or she would just be going, oh, tum-ti-tum-ti-tum, I feel pretty good today. Maybe I'll have some cake for lunch. You just wouldn't know they're there. It's just normal. They don't do anything to humans.
Come on, that's not quite true, is it, Benny?
Not quite. Yeah, you've got me there. Can't lie. Some actually do human beings a favour, totally without being asked. Some microbes will fight off other invading microbes that could be harmful. Those pesky germs. Thoughtful.
I didn't mean that. I was talking about those harmful ones.
That's true, but can't stress this enough. They're a tiny minority. Less than 5% of microbes and just 1% of bacteria are harmful. We call those ones germs. Sorry, mate, but you're a germ, Mal.
Guilty as charged. There might not be many of us germs compared to all the helpful microbes, but like most bacteria, we're always looking for a way inside the human body. It's a great place for us to be, warm and wet, perfect for making copies of ourselves. Difference is that when we start making copies, you might start feeling sick.
Go on then, spill the beans on how it's done.
From the top, the first way inside is... through the nose, straight up the hooter. You can breathe the germs in, and when you pick your nose, any germs on your finger are going to get a super speedy shortcut inside. Way! And I love it when that happens. Next way in, through your mouth. If you're thinking of eating that bogey you just pulled out of your nose, you'll be giving me or one of my closest friends a lovely trip inside your body. Last way, through your skin if you have cuts or grazes.
So, the really important thing to take away from what Mal's just said is that all three of those ways are pretty easy to do something about. Don't pick your nose, that's one, isn't it? Don't eat bogies, obviously, that's just nasty. Make sure you cover up cuts with a plaster, and make sure you wash your hands if they might have picked up more germs than normal.
Don't know why you're telling them all that. They'll be washing helpful microbes like you away too.
Yeah, but I see the bigger picture, don't I? Humans need to look after themselves. No different to you or me. Human bodies are seriously impressive when it comes to keeping germs at bay, aren't they?
Tell me about it. It's so annoying. Shall I do the honours?
Be my guest.
All that disgusting, sticky mucus you have up your nose and windpipe traps the invading germs, and tiny hairs waft them into the throat where you lot cough, sneeze or blow them out.
So, you might want to think about using a tissue to cover your mouth. Otherwise, you're just passing the germs on to someone else. Little tip from me there.
I hate tissues and handkerchiefs. They just get in the way. So there's that. Scabs. They're another way we get locked out. They're not just there for picking.
In fact, that's a good reason not to pick your scabs. I know it's hard. We all love a good picky scab, don't we? Be honest. Oh, I've got another one. Tears. You know when you cry? They're actually antiseptic. They can kill germs. I couldn't believe it either, first time I heard. It's like a superpower, isn't it?
Not as scary for us lot as the stomach. If we're lucky enough to get all of the way inside your tummy, it's like being dropped into a swimming pool of acid.
Stomach's definitely the worst. But a lot of the troublemakers just won't make it through the skin. It's a pretty tough barrier to break through, and it even produces substances to kill off germs. Oh, I think I might possibly be about to divide. How about you, Mal?
Yeah, definitely feeling dividey.
Dividing is something we bacteria can't help doing, making copies of ourselves by splitting in two, basically. Here we go. So, anyway, we better go. As you can see, microbes come in all sorts. Vast majority don't bother humans at all and can even be helpful. I hope Mal and I have been helpful microbes for you today.
You definitely have. Thanks, Benny and Mal. See you next time.
Follow the adventures of Benny and Mal on funkidslive.com/bugs. Good Bug, Bad Bug, produced with support from the Society for General Microbiology.
And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. If you have anything sciencey that you want answered on the show next week, we get a genius on every time for you. A proper expert in the field answering your question. Make sure you leave it as a voice note for me on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. You heard from Benny and Mal today. Loads more episodes from them and other brilliant podcast series that we've got for you on Google, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your shows. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com too. And Fun Kids, we are a children's radio station from the UK. You can listen all over the place on our app, on the website. And if you've got a smart speaker, like we heard earlier with Pip, with its tiny little microphone, make sure you wake it up and ask it to play Fun Kids.